For beginners, we normally do, but this requires you to be comfortable in your seat. So just move about until you do feel comfortable. Ideally, your back should be straight and your shoulders relaxed. The head is sitting evenly upon your neck. And your eyes should be partially closed or fully closed, or just leave them as they are. Once you are sitting comfortably, just allow your body to breathe itself. Feeling the body breathe itself. Just relax into awareness. And from a state of relaxed awareness, imagine that the ground beneath you is made of lapis lazuli, and the space above you is filled with rainbows and offerings. Directly in front of you, at the level of your eyebrows, is a golden throne, and sitting upon that throne is the Buddha Shakyamuni. He's surrounded by an assembly of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, deities, and other enlightened beings. Meanwhile, you are surrounded by all sentient beings. So your mother is sitting beside you on the left, your father on the right. Friends and family are directly behind you, and difficult people are directly in front of you. Surrounding these people are many others who are strangers to you. And you're about to lead all these sentient beings in the safe direction of the three jewels of refuge. So before you do that, just recollect on how fortunate you are to still be alive today. Now, the causes of death are many, while those that sustain life are very few. And death can take place at any time. But we are still alive, and we have the leisure and opportunity to attain our spiritual goals. You will have to act quickly, though, because things are not quite right. The world does not exist as it appears to. Nevertheless, we have met a spiritual friend. And this trustworthy person is leading us in the safe direction of the Triple Gem. The three rarest of blood ones, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Now, to make our offering of practice as purely as possible, imagine yourself be as clear as a deity. And while being as clear as a deity, you are holding a vajra and bell. And you're sitting within a sphere of great bliss, of great enjoyment. Then acknowledging the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha in front of you, join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. In response to this prayer of yours, imagine that from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectar stream down. And these dissolve with yourself and all the living beings surrounding you. Negative karmas and obstructions are purified. Your health and lifespan, along with your virtues and realizations, are increased. So cleansed by wisdom, fortified with compassionate love, I recollect the four emotional thoughts. decide to develop these yourself, and to also establish all beings into those four immeasurable states. To affirm this, join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. In response to this wish of yours, lights and nectar stream down from the field of enlightenment. And these lights and nectars dissolve into yourself and all living beings who surround you. And your negative karmas and obstructions are purified. Your health and lifespan, along with your virtues and realizations, are increased. The next time you exhale, just relax completely. And from that relaxed state of awareness, invite a field for accumulating merit, which appeared. And in front of them, you say, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, action, and momentum. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since the beginning of this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. So to prevent ourselves from clinging to the merit as truly real, recollect emptiness and dissolve your body, speech, mind, and all the enjoyments and the universe itself. Dissolve the appearances of true existence using the wisdom realizing emptiness. And have everything reappear as a wonderful pure land where you can give future teachings to your disciples. And join me in saying that this ground, anointed with perfumes, strewn with flowers, adorned with burnt myrrh, four continents of sun and moon, I imagine this as a Buddha field of offering. May all living beings enjoy its pure land. Yidam Guru Akamanda Kamarata. So you've released the offering, and the Buddha has accepted, and he smiles at you with delight. You look up into the eyes of the Buddha. You recollect your determination to give up the causes of suffering, to develop a mind of enlightenment, and to establish the correct view of all phenomena empty of intrinsic existence, yet dependently arise. So induced by your prayers and your wishes, there emerges from the Buddha a second figure who absorbs into you. Your form clearly becomes that of the Guru Buddha. Radiating from a syllable at your heart, light rays strike all sentient beings surrounding you and place them each in the state of the Guru Buddha. So yourself and all beings are now fully awakened, fully enlightened. And at the heart of each of you is a moon disc, upon which is a white mantra. It's encircled by the mantra, which you begin to recite. So, Tayata Omni Mahamudra. Tayata Omni Mahamudra. Tayata Omni Mahamudra. Thank you. मुनि मुनि महामुनाय are drawn into your heart in the form of light. Think yourself, I've accomplished my purpose. Which means you've enlightened yourself and you've brought all beings to enlightenment. Then recognize that this meditation you've just done is one of imagination. And this imagination has imprinted your mind as the possibility of your full awakening for the benefit of all beings. So let's rejoice in that and decide for yourself that we've come here to the center to learn about the Dharma. We've come here to learn about how to meditate. The meditations we are engaged in are a union of method and wisdom, which we seek to bring about our full enlightenment for the benefit of all. And then breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth, and it's your eyes start open in your own time. Okay, let's have a look at what we've done. So last week we looked at laziness, one of the things we looked at, and we also looked at three other phenomena called scattering, excitement and distraction. So can anybody, so laziness had four opponents. Can anybody remember what the first one
Sleeping.
was? I think that supports laziness. Ben? The fact is called faith. So the first thing we use against laziness is faith. From this faith in all the good qualities that meditation will produce. From that comes aspiration to achieve that, which requires your effort, which ends up when you have an pliant mind. So the actual antidote is pliancy, but it requires faith, aspiration, and effort, joyous effort, to overcome laziness. Then we talked about these other phenomena that are problematic, like I said, scattering. The mind is affected by attachment and sort of moves outwardly. You have excitement and distraction. We've also talked about placement and analysis and the posture for meditating, and also why you want to meditate, meditation itself. I've relied upon Sorry. Today we're going to work with a couple of other problems. So last week's class, I was going to do laziness, lethargy, and laxity. Because I thought, oh, three L's, they all go together. But they don't go so well together when you're actually trying to practice. What you first meet up with is laziness, which is the most common laziness. You just don't want to do it. You got too much on the plate. But today we're going to be talking about lethargy and laxity, and also their opponents, of course, being most is mindfulness and vigilance. Lethargy and laxity, of course. And the material I've drawn come across is from these books here. I said probably the easiest of them all to read is here would be this Attention Revolution. Is a really good overview of the nine stages that are required to produce calm abiding. It's pretty straightforward. The other books will be easy. Following the Buddha's Footsteps, The Foundation, Steps on the Path to Enlightenment. The other two you want to leave a couple of years because it's quite taxing. It's very, it's like it's come out of a university thesis or something. It's like a PhD material, but it's full of great material. It's just not so easy to read. Okay, so when we begin to meditate, there's a number of different problems we're going to meet up with. So the first thing is we sit down, we say, okay, we're going to meditate out our object. What happens pretty quickly is you forget the object or you forget the instructions. So you have to find out what is the object we need to be on and what are the instructions. In other words, we need to sort of remember. But we get distracted due to forgetfulness. The second thing that happens is it's very easy to fall under the sway of laxity and excitement. So pretty quickly, I'll show you what this word laxity means, but we're going to start off with something easier called lethargy. So there are different types of lethargy. Here, you can see it's not one of the root afflictions, it's one of the 20 secondary afflictions. Otherwise, and that's its coarse nature. But lethargy also has a subtle nature, and this is when it comes up in the four neutral mental factors. Does anybody remember some of what the neutral mental factors are?
Sleep.
Sleep is one of them, and lethargy is tied up with sleep. So, can anybody remember another neutral mental factor? It's what's called regret. Because regret can go, you can regret good things, and you can also regret bad things. So it's stuck right there in the neutral thing. It really is. It's not a non-virtue, it's not a virtue. Four major ones there. So when you hear the word lethargy, what does it conjure up for you? You know, when you say, oh man, I'm so lethargic. What do you think?
Heaviness.
Heavy. Heaviness?
You just weariness, can't be bothered.
Can't be bothered, weary, heavy,
Tired.
tired, drowsy, sort of sleepy, drowsy, sleepy. All these words are sort of completely, and this is a general meaning here too, with lethargy. The lethargy is a sort of a heaviness of body and mind that is really close to sleep. And lethargy causes the decline of both the stability and the clarity of the object you're trying to hold on to. But so the mind becomes dull and passive. It may even begin to dream. And it's a derivative of delusion. Now, lethargy. One of the things about lethargy is a cause for laxity. This is the thing I think we need to remember here. These are two major things we're talking about, lethargy and laxity. So lethargy, we're staying here for a little bit. So lethargy, like I said, it really does lead to sleepiness. It's, like I say, heavy. It's very easy if you're lethargic to what we call go on the nod. You go like this, and you're tired, you basically want to rest. Here are some of the causes of lethargy and sleepiness. So they're not the same thing, but lethargy can lead to sleepiness. So bad dreams. If you spent the night up with bad dreams, you're going to be really tired. That's what this lethargy means. Find yourself dragging yourself around. It's tiring. Nothing is if you're really unhappy. You don't want to do anything. This is also a cause for lethargy. Physical exhaustion. Another thing, of course, you always find this happens if you eat and then meditate within a short period of time, lethargy can creep in there. It's just, again, it's your body's heavy, got the food in it. It hasn't digested it yet, things like that. Another thing, of course, and probably quite a common one, is depression. If you're prone to depressive states, then it's very easy to become lethargic and sleepy. In fact, if you've ever been depressed, that's what I found I do a lot, is sleep. Just lie around a lot. Lethargy, like I said, lethargy and sleepiness, they're two different factors. They're described as quite separate mental factors. But they're explained together because they have the same cause, function, and antidote. So here are some of the, like I said, these causes of Lethargy are the same for sleepiness here. So both of sleepiness and lethargy function to make the body and mind dull, and they are counteracted by a bright, alert mind. So if you were to try and brighten up the mind or make it more alert, what do you think you might do to work against lethargy or sleepiness? Any ideas?
Light, bringing in light, making sure it's not
yep.
too dark.
Yep, that's a good idea. So you can either visualize light or imagine light. And oftentimes it's like you want to put it up sort of high. Yeah, like remember last time we talked about bringing the mind down to stop the excitement. We had to imagine that little black pearl or a teardrop down in your belly. Here, if you want to brighten up, you look up, the light shines in. What's another simple thing you can do?
What about changing the time of day that you do it?
Yep, that would do it too. If you find you're tired at the time you do it, don't do it then. Find a better time to do it. Make sure you get some sleep. That also helps. Right?
Even though it's the mind jumping your body around.
That's right. If you do something physical, if you do prostrations before you meditate, you notice a big difference immediately. Another simple thing you can do is just bring into your room, or you either bring into your session a glass of water, and you can put your fingers in and put them on your eyes. Right? Because you've got to wake yourself up. The other thing is drink water. This is another great way to become really lethargic. Right? So drink lots of fluids. Drink water. And as one of the lamas has told us before, he said what they used to do was they'd go outside and they'd get these little chili peppers and they rub them on their fingers like this, so you don't put them in your eyes. But you might put them around your nostrils. It'd be like a big... Yeah, so that might help you too. Often they'll say, just if you're feeling really excited, go up and have a walk. Walk, just do something different than coming. Physical exercise is probably the best thing you can do. And like I said, prostration is terrific. Purify the mind first, then come and do the meditation. So opposing lethargy and sleepiness. So I've written down a verse here. It says, the entire world is burning up by the fire of death. You should be seeking means of escape. How then can you sleep? You're like a person in shackles being led to his execution with disastrous harm so imminent. How can you sleep? So can you see what the idea is behind this verse? What are they trying to, what do you think they're trying to encourage us to do here?
Wake up.
They're to wake up, and what's to wake us up?
Yeah.
Fear of imminent death. So if you think you're going to die at any moment, I dare to sleep. That's what it's sort of saying, right? Who could go to sleep when you know the next moment you could be dead? You just wouldn't do it. So this is one of the ways they say to you, though, if you are lethargic, start thinking about dying in the very next few moments. Now, of course, if you are really depressed, this is not the thing to think, right? Because you might just roll over and go, good, I'll die. So all the time, all this advice, it's really, it's highly dependent upon other factors. Yeah, it's always relative. That's right. Always relative, this advice. But sometimes you might take this advice, and then at another time, like I say, you might be a bit depressed. So go, no, not this one now. Now it's better bright light. Or maybe I just need to go to the bathroom and wash my face and put cold water on my neck. You're just going to find, like I said, there's a number of different remedies they introduce you to, but the one is you got to find out what works for you. So here's from His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, saying, following the Buddha's footsteps, he says, during your breaks, look at long distances, or look at the stars and the moon at night to enlarge your mental scope. Make the meditation room cooler or remove your sweater. Avoid overheating. Splash cold water on your face before the session. There's lots of practical pith and advice given like this. Now, you guys, what's interesting about this? Is there anything? Does anybody have this problem being lethargic about the meditations?
Would it be a bad idea to kind of try and force yourself to not be lethargic, like to, really...
Put your teeth in.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, is that not a good idea?
Well, I'd try and find easier methods than that. Go easy first, right? If you have no other option. But then often, if that's the case, then I forget, you probably need actual sleep.
Right.
You probably are really tired. And so don't have a rest.
Right.
You know, maybe even have a cold shower or cold water on yourself and come back. In fact, I remember one time at CI, at Timmins Institute, a number of us had been in the course, it was so hot. Everybody had to leave the golf cart, go outside in the front, just down below the stairs there. We all had to do it there. And I had this idea, so up at the Sangha house there, where Little Pende base will be, they have a fridge up there. So I got this bowl and filled it up with water, and I got a face washer, dropped it in the water, and it soaked it all up, and I put it into the freezer box. And came out, and I waited about an hour, and everybody else was that we were all sweating. It was like horrible. Bolted back up, the sun has come back. I had a little beanie on top, like this Jewish little hats. Just flipped it up, completely cool. And I could stay there and listen. Everybody thought that was a good idea after that. So, of course, after that, was everyone's face washes in the fridge, on your neck, everything. You have to find ways to stay awake. It's just so hot and muggy. Yeah, so as a beginner, always remember, you will struggle with your sessions, and the longer they are, the more you'll struggle. And what you'll struggle with is this lethargy or excitement. One is you become really distracted, the other is you become sort of really tired and sleepy. And you need to find ways of dealing with both of those. So now we're going to talk about this new phenomenon called laxity, and it is not lethargy. So is laxity lethargy? The answer is no. So lethargy is non-virtuous or ethically neutral, and it's the cause for laxity. I'll tell you more about it very shortly. Whereas laxity is virtuous or ethically neutral, and it's a result of lethargy. So you know what laxity, you already know what lethargy is, don't you? Tell me what lethargy is, somebody. It's heaviness of body and mind.
That stops you doing things and being
right.
able to think. It's like hot, heavy feeling.
Yeah, that's right. It can lead to depression, all these sort of things. They have elements of that in there. So you really say, I'm so tired. It's like that. But that is the lethargy. Lethargy is going to bring about another state called laxity. That's what's going to happen. That's what we're sort of getting at. How one state can lead to another. So this is to say something about this from, and this is from Geshe Sopa's book. He says, most Tibetan practitioners of Tsongkhapa's time seemed to define laxity as a lethargic state of mind. It stays on its object of meditation without being distracted, but it has no limpid clarity. The two, according to Tsongkhapa, these yogis have mistakenly conflated laxity and lethargy. Meaning, in other words, you say these guys think they're the same, but in fact, Lama Tsongkhapa says they're not. two are not the same. Lethargy is a cause of laxity. If something is a cause of another thing, it can't be identical with it. Right? So this is why they are different. So lethargy, again, is a heaviness of body and mind that can lead to sleep. It's very close to sleepiness, but it's not sleep. But when, so lethargy here can lead to sleepiness. Lethargy can also lead to laxity. So there's two things that can go towards. Is laxity a non-virtuous phenomena? It's not a root affliction. It's not a secondary affliction. It's interesting, isn't it? Where the affliction can lead to some new state, but this new state is not an affliction. So what is it? Simply, it's this. However, this is interesting too. So Lama Tsongkhapa says, there is no clear presentation of the definition of laxity in all the texts that he read. So I remember we did this with Geshe-la. This part took quite a bit of time, right? Going around saying no clear definition. Now we've got room for debate. So then Geshe-la, of course, leads it into debate. But laxity, remember, lethargy was what? Lethargy was heaviness of body and mind, leading to sleepiness, and it can also lead to laxity, can't it? So if it goes to sleepiness, what happens?
Sorry.
If our lethargy leads to sleepiness, what happens?
We
fall asleep. We lose the meditative object altogether. Yeah. Laxity, you don't. You keep the object stays there. You don't lose it altogether. It's still there. But how it's there is not really conducive to your meditating. Does this help you a little? So lethargy leads to sleepiness and to laxity. If we fall asleep, we don't have an object of meditation, it's gone completely. Laxity, we do have the object. Your mind is not holding the object or apprehending the object, but it's vividness or firmness. His laxity, which has both coarse and subtle forms, is a loosening of the mental clarity of your object. The mind becomes weak, just as it is right before you fall asleep. This can be very subtle. Subtle mental laxity can look like deep meditation with no distraction, but there is a slight loosening of the object. Your mind may be firmly, single-pointedly on its object, but it becomes too internalized. As you sink more and more into dullness, darkness and a lack of clarity become more apparent. At this point, people fall asleep. So now it's not, this is not easy to identify. It actually, you'll actually have to only really know yourself in practice doing it. I mean, sure, you can hear me and read about it. But if you try it out to actually identify it, it's not so easy. Yeah, and laxity really becomes the problem sort of around about the fourth stage of developing karma body. It's really there where excitement and laxity really come to the fore. And it's really there where you apply more mindfulness and introspection. Let's have a look at how to identify laxity. These are the primary ways. You have to develop what they call vigilance. Remember, vigilance is another term and word for introspection. So it's like you're sort of, let's say, So if I had this clock, right? So it's in my hand, I'm paying attention to it. So that would be like mindfulness. But vigilance or introspection is sort of, you know, I've got the object, but I'm still looking a bit more about the object and making sure at the same time my mind is on. Like I just went like that and suddenly that, oh, the numbers disappeared. So vigilance is telling all about the state, the object, and also how your mind is holding it. Mindfulness just holds it. That's its job. It's like memory. So this ability to look at the object, remember it's an internal object, and what's looking at it, your mind. So it's an interesting phenomenon, isn't it? You're looking at the subjective awareness and the object. Whereas with mindfulness, it just goes the object. So we have to develop this vigilance. We also have to strengthen it. And we have to strengthen mindfulness. The way you strengthen vigilance and develop it is through mindfulness. Strange. You know, if you want to be good vigilance, you don't start with that, you do the other side. Just hold that object and make sure it's clear. If you have it clearly, and then they say that the mind sort of limping. Because identifying laxity in our own experience is essential. Again, this is from the Dalai Lama. It takes time and effort to observe how our mind operates. But doing this is the key to making the Dharma come alive for us. He goes on to say, skill is required to use vigilance properly to identify laxity. If our introspective awareness is weak, we won't recognize interruptions to concentration. If it is overactive, it interrupts the flow of concentration and prevents the mind from becoming stable. When we are more familiar with the object and our attention span is longer, introspective awareness is needed to check for faults such as restlessness and laxity. Until your introspective awareness is strong, the meditation remains prey to those two faults of laxity and excitement. Until you meditate and examine your mind with introspection, it will be very difficult to understand the nature of laxity. Until you have some experience with this practice, all these teachings can seem strange. It's not enough to simply know the characteristics of laxity and excitement and some related mental factors. We must develop vigilance, the primary antidote to laxity and excitement, so that you can actually recognize the presence of those two obstacles. In other words, if you don't have an introspective awareness or this vigilance, you won't even know what laxity is. You won't know what excitement is. But remember, mindfulness is holding the object. These other mental factors that you can tell, what's my mind doing? How's the object appearing to my mind? Like I know for myself for a long time, many years, all that was appearing to me was blackness all the time. No matter what people said, imagine this and try and visualize that, it was like nothing. It's just black. And I read about what that means, it's like not good. It's not good. It took quite a long time for something to. And I had to use, I couldn't use the word, visualize, because I couldn't see it, nothing would happen. But if I said imagine, then it sort of came easier. So I was like, if you can imagine this, I can imagine it. But if I try then like sit there and try to picture it, it's not happening. So for me, it was just a way of finding the right words. But I've come across many people who say, I can't visualize, all I see is black, or there's nothing happens. And there are some people that have a medical condition where that actually does take place. You don't imagine or visualize like that.
And I think there's a range of ability here, because obviously artists are very good at visualizing.
Yeah.
And then there's going to be some people that are very bad.
Okay, so here's some of the causes of laxity. So interesting, eh? Not restraining the sensory faculties, meaning you engage yourself fully in the objects of the senses. Can you see why that might be a problem? Because the senses are pushing everything outwards, eh? They're going out, right, to get the data. This stuff, you're going in. So you've got to sort of create a mental image and then hold it in your mind and then examine it and make sure it's nice and vivid and so forth. Yeah, so we keep pushing the senses outwards, that makes it more difficult. You're not eating in moderation, so you eat perhaps too much or at the wrong time, and then you go to meditate. This will have a poor effect on your ability to visualize and hold it. A third one, of course, is you just don't try. You think, I can't do it, I'll try this again and again, nothing's working, so forth. There's a thing called the ongoing lack of vigilance. There's things called oversleeping, being unskillful, being lazy, everyone's aspirations. There's a lot of causes of laxity. And here I took it from the Lam and Chinmo, like 14 of them. Yeah, so this is not so bad, eh? When you get a list like that, you can check out and go, well, I can't do it. What might be the problem? You can look down here, find these things. So when laxity is set in, when has it set in? So this is a very simple way. When your mind's way of knowing the object is not highly vivid. Like, for instance, this clock, right? If you just look at it from where you are, so what can you see from where you are? Does this appear like vividly to your eyes? You haven't got glasses, it probably won't be, but you can all perhaps see it's a white object like this, isn't it? Got a little bit of black right in there. So I just put it on there, you try and imagine it, try and visualize it. So which one's more vivid to you? This one here, or the one you got in your mind? Your one's better in the mind?
Yeah, much.
Okay.
Well, I've been playing, like when you said imagine it, I've turned up the vividness, turned it down, and then I turned it up, make it like shiny.
Yeah, okay. Well, this is great ideas. This is what you need to do. Play around with your mind.
It's fine.
Yeah, play with these things and see what happens. Yeah, so one of my big mistakes is like, I thought that, you know, you just say it and it would be, or you'd read it, or because you want it happens. It doesn't. You've actually sort of got to like talk it into existence and then start playing. Yeah, so laxity is basically a really sort of a dull mind and it doesn't have a clear focus. And that's one of the worst things for this. So what they talk about this is because laxity is the worst thing that can happen to you. And the hard, difficult thing is you don't even recognize it's happening. Mm-hmm. And so what can happen over time is you get good at holding that, you pull up an image, it's no problem. It's like, great, I've got it. And you think, that's it, that's good enough. And so then you stay on it for like a long time, maybe 20 minutes, great, 30, 40, an hour. But all the time what you're also developing is this laxity. And it's really, really hard to undo. Like I say, you only sort of get to know it through like reading and then experience itself. Like as I say, turn it up, drop it down, see what happens. Yeah, so if you miss the boat on this, there's no chance of you getting into this. Into is a very subtle object. So if you're lax, what will happen, of course, you know, the emptiness of an inherently existent phenomenon, no phenomena appear to your mind. Right? And so you're just like, you know, dull. You're not getting an emptiness at all. You're getting it like nothing. You're thinking, well, that's it. I've got it. And you haven't. You're way off the mark. So anyway, when you read the material on this, there's lots of warnings about laxity. It says, laxity is a subtle obstacle where your mind, though stable, becomes dull and loses its vividness. Its function is to weaken concentration. It's caused by the mind withdrawing too much. So what's happening? Like I said, your senses go out. Meditating, your senses, you withdraw them, right? You close them down and you come inside. And if you do that too often and too much without this vividness, this is what happens. It becomes lax. There's no brightness, no vividness. It's caused by the mind withdrawing too much, leading to sleepiness or a lack of delight. Key signs are a hazy focus and a heavy, spaced out feeling. Man, I had that all today. Yeah. Recognizing it is the first step to restoring the bright clarity needed for effective meditation. The causes of laxity are both internal and external. Internally, it comes from the mind being overly withdrawn, which leads to sleepiness and the gloomy feeling. This can be triggered by lifestyle factors like not eating in moderation, not getting enough rest, or a general lack of joyous effort. Because while you aren't necessarily thinking about other things, your mind lacks force and feels hazy. This is, if your mind becomes slack, inspire yourself by cultivating delight. So to oppose these causes of laxity, we've got these different things, the suspension of it, suspending laxity. So go for a walk. These are really, like I said, the simplest things I can put up. Go for a walk. A bright light, or imagine an image of brightness in your mind, and you have to sort of familiarize yourself with it again and again and again, so it comes up quite easily. And also that you know that it is the brightness. So here the six recollections are to recollect the Buddha, the teaching, the spiritual community, ethical discipline, generosity, the deities. There's a lot of methods you can use here to do this. And I say last week, we told it, there will come a time in your meditation where you can't go forwards. You're stuck. And that means you have to stop meditating on what you're doing at the moment and apply the antidotes to whatever's keeping you stuck. And this is when you can do these sort of things. Once you weaken the obstacle, then you can start again. Stimulate the mind by means of other inspiring objects of meditation. So if you have texts that you have memorized, like the Heart Sutra, for instance, or I like the praises to Manjushri, there's great praise to the Buddha. If you come across these sort of things and they resonate with you, then start doing those. Just take a little break from what you're doing. You've got to get invigorate the mind somehow. So this means, like I said, gazing in different directions. So like tonight, perhaps, you know, I'd go, like I probably will tonight, just go out there and sit on the balcony and look out into space. Just look up. If it's in the daytime, you know, long vistas or going up to where the sea is and just not thinking, but just gazing and getting light. And of course, just washing your face with water.
Hey.
Yeah.
During purges, when the bells go off, I find that sound really bright into my mind.
Okay. Yeah.
Objects of the senses.
Yeah, so it might be tricky with that, isn't it? Because you've got this external thing coming in, you're trying to hold an internal image.
But it certainly like brightens, I feel, if anything really bright, that's kind of
a thing. Well, maybe we should try it again and try it then, and then try your object again to see how you go. You might end up holding a bell. Yeah, direct your mind to delightful things that cause it to expand outward. So laxity makes it impossible to hold the object of focus with any clarity. It causes the practice to become ineffective and frustrating. Yes, we have to apply antidotes that energize and uplift our awareness. Okay, again, anything you'd like to ask about this? Yes?
How can Lakshmi be virtuous? Here I am trying to think of the possible ways, and I can't think of it. I mean, unless it's like you're scheming something, you have it in great detail, and then you lose focus, and then you're like, okay, so.
Well, how about so you have the object of the Buddha in mind, but the mind itself is lax.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right, I see what you mean. Okay. I was going in the other direction. Yeah, interesting. So at least you have the object in mind and you're not asleep.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you haven't forgotten it altogether.
So it's kind of like a mild, mild virtuous thing. Compared to, if you don't have laxity, then you'd be more virtuous.
Yes.
Presumably.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, the intention is the primary thing, of course, and then you have your object, but then it's like how it's held. And so it can be really strong or weakened. Yeah, that's right. We would want to become lax, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But you could.
Laxity sounds a lot like dissociation to me.
Dissociating? Yeah, I'm not sure.
Sandy? And it just comes back to Stefan's question. Is it virtuous because it's not non-virtuous?
No, because we have virtuous, neutral, and non-virtuous.
Yeah.
So this ties in more with the neutral virtue. Neutral virtuous. Yeah, so we start off with sleep, for instance. Let's say neutral object.
With the neutral object, in fact, I can carry it away.
That's right.
Yeah. So your laxity could carry it
either way. That's right. Okay, let's do a brief meditation on this material. Oh. So as we're engaged in the practices of the Mahayana, let's set an altruistic motivation to cultivate a mind that's not just calm, but it's also brilliantly clear. So laxity is the subtle dullness that can arise when the mind withdraws too much. Its function is to weaken concentration. Now, its antidote is not to force focus, but to skillfully uplift and energize your awareness. Without this So laxity is when the batteries are dying. It makes the light dim. While uplifting thoughts like the fresh batteries. So how might you be able to tell the difference between a peaceful calm and from peaceful calm and dull laxity in your own experience? We're trying to use this analogy of the flashlight and the batteries. So peaceful and calm is that bright, steady beam from the flashlight. And laxity is when that same beam becomes weak and hazy. So why do you think simply trying harder is an ineffective antidote for laxity?
Struggling with laxity in the first place, trying hard.
Well, it's like trying hard is like shaking the flashlight.
That's a good one. Sorry.
It won't fix the problem. Yeah. You know, you need to put in fresh batteries. This is a joyful energy. So I wonder what kind of thought could serve as a fresh battery for us right now, right? So a fresh battery of thought could be or might be a memory of kindness or an inspiring quality that someone has. But any thought that can act as a fresh battery. So you make your mind become brighter and clearer. And so whenever we meditate, try to simply notice the quality of the light of the mind. You know, you have the power not just to hold that flashlight, but to keep the light brilliant and clear and bright. And breathing out through the mouth, let your eyes flutter open. Yeah, it's amazing, this thing I said about the battery, the new battery. I immediately thought of Geshe-la and immediately felt, ooh, I can just tell, so I just perked up. And I thought, wow, there it is, just like that. Or, yeah, somebody being kind to you, oh, that's why I'm meditating. Now, like I said, the two features needed to overcome laxity, these are mindfulness. You have to ask us, is the object of focus present? Have you remembered it? And vigilance, has it been forgotten? Is there this dullness? Is there excitement? Because vigilance works against excitement and laxity. It's to really tell you about the quality of your awareness. Let's spend a little time now talking about our mindfulness. Now, the nature of mindfulness, so you have to have a familiar object. In relation to that familiar object, you don't forget it, and so you're not distracted. And the mindfulness becomes strong and powerful by you just gently returning your mind each time you forget back to the object. The problem is it's not so much forgetting the object, it's getting the mind to go back to it. That's what develops the mindfulness. So if you forget the object, you shouldn't be hard on yourself. That's normal. What's not so normal is to come back to your original object. You know, most people, they get distracted, they just keep going, don't they? You're distracted, it's like, oh, and you go, oh, that's right, I was still talking about that, wasn't it? Now you're back on again. The strength of mindfulness, like I said, it's normal to forget your object. It's natural. But to bring it back, that's not so normal. And that's what we call mindfulness.
What happens, if I'm just follow what you said, extrapolate from that, over time, does it happen that you'll eventually, your mind won't move off the object? If you become really good at bringing it in,
over time, it becomes... Over time, you'll be able to keep your mind on that object for as long as you like.
And all that we have to do is practice bringing it back in.
That's right. That gives you the skill to do it. Yeah.
Catch it quicker.
Sorry?
You catch it quicker the more you practice.
Yes, you will. You will catch it quicker. And just the fact that you hold it there, you know, because it could, I mean, for many of us, how long do any of us try to hold any idea in mind? For how long? I'm sure most of us hardly anything, eh? Yeah, that's right. I mean, to stay. That's right. And in fact, they use the idea of the dog. You know, when you go, when you want the dog to pee or go to the loo in its place, it goes wherever it wants to in the beginning, don't it? Doesn't it? Just goes and pees wherever it wants to. You have to pick it up and you have to take it to the place where it should go. And you put it there and then it'll do its wing. Then it'll just wander off and go and wee somewhere else. You have to pick it back up and you have to bring it back. And over not too long, it knows where to go, and it just goes there. It's the same idea with mindfulness and using the mind. It's not used to going there, so it wanders off. What we know we want it here is a good purpose for it, so we have to put it back there. And so we do.
On that, Lama Tsongkhapa in the concentration chapter also talked about monitoring. It's like almost like a fail-safe or like a secondary system. That's how I wanted to maybe give you a comment on it, is so when you are, it's something that looks at how you hold the object. And so that if you start loosening and almost ready to go, that's kind of like warning.
Yeah, that's the vigilance introspection.
Oh, that's. And so, okay, so that's... That is vigilance. It's interesting because he said monitoring at some stage. Talk about vigilance, but then he said monitoring, right? And that's what he meant.
Yeah.
Because he likes talking about security guard. Security guard is keeping an eye on him.
I often say another analogy they use or metaphor, they use like mindfulness and vigilance are like two guards. But one is more obviously the guard, the other not so obvious. So the actual guard is mindfulness and he's at the door. Mm-hmm. But his buddy, vigilance, is out there keeping an eye on what's going on out here.
Yeah.
And keeping at the same time looking at what's going on here, keeping an eye on my mate too. Is he still at the door? Mm-hmm. So they use that idea about, you know, a guard and an assistant, but then you're a spy. And he's keeping a lookout at the people who might come to the door. He's also keeping an eye on his mate, the guard, at the door.
Who's keeping an eye on that guy?
If you can keep like four things in mind.
I thought you were going to say, so who's on third? Yes. Okay, so again, we know it has to be a familiar object. You don't forget that object, and like I said, it stops distraction. The three minor features is this. Again, it's always an object that you need to be familiar with. You don't forget, and of course your attention will not wander. And as you're probably quite aware of, they use this picture of the elephant. So the elephant, of course, is often black. In this case, it's a very small elephant, and it's telling you that this little elephant represents your own mind that is not under your control. So you can see here the trainer of this mind has actually tied the elephant to a pole. And so the elephant, that's crazy mind, a wandering mind. The rope is the mindfulness. The rope ties the elephant to the pole. The pole is our meditation object. The mind is our elephant. Mindfulness connects the elephant of the mind to the object of our meditation. That's the pillar. That's the object of meditation. Now the hook. The hook is not seen here. Now the hook represents vigilance. So the trainer, so you can see mindfulness is the rope which tied it to the object. The trainer's tied it there. The trainer's gone off to get his hook. And what the hook does, they're called goads, aren't they? And if the elephant doesn't pop, they're just, you're pulling like this, it just gives a prod. Hey, relax. So that's what the Vincent's or introspection is to do. Check up this object called mind. How's it behaving with its object? But yet still tied to it, yet still on the, if that fell away, you know, oh my gosh, the elephant's free. Vigilance knows that, this introspection. But while it's tied to it, it's interested in how's the mind behaving. Now, is it excitable? Is it lethargic? Is it dropped down to laxity? To becoming black, all these sort of things. And of course, the trainer is that's us. We have our own elephant in the room, and we're going to work with it. So, the purpose of vigilance, of course, is basically to consistently assess your mental situation. Internal situation. Yeah, it's concerned with the subjective, but also you got to remember also with that other object, because if mindfulness is lost, right, it's got to know it's not on that object.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. But right on track there is primarily the subjective awareness. It's really interested in that, especially when it comes to this laxity. Because it's not so much about the object there, it's how the mind is relating to it. Yeah, the quality of your awareness. It's more about that. It also tells you, like I say, is excitement occurring? Is laxity occurring? I think this analogy of the flashlight is quite a good one, because we all know, don't we? We've had a light and suddenly it's gotten dim. You go, Jesus, I need new batteries. So, you know, we could sit down and sort of tell like how well is my mind engaging with a subject. That's what you'd like, isn't it?
Right, you're on track.
Oh. Yeah, of course it won't be, but you want to get as sort of close as possible, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like your internal world is as real as your external, isn't it?
It's just like, you know, if I can visualize this internally, as vivid as it is,
yeah. That'd
be a good benchmark.
Oh, yeah. So have you seen those guys on... you see those fellows? Well, one fellow I know, they took them, put them in a plane, and rode over New York City. Right? And they landed, and then he drew everything they went over.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's all sort of mental imagery.
Like an autistic boy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's different people like to say it. They can do this.
Or like engineers have got, in psychology we call it visual spatial reasoning. It's a kind of so the engineers are quite visual and they can often manipulate things in their minds visually to, you know, especially mechanical engineers can see how things work.
Yeah, like I say, you're sort of quite clear, aren't you? You want a good image in your mind.
A question from Georgie online. Mm-hmm. She says, in constantly assessing your mental situation, wouldn't you then be in danger of losing your object by doing that monitoring?
No, the optics, because you really, the object should be, if the object disappears, yes, Georgie, you've just gone, you've called that excitement. But once too much. And there is warnings about this. There are times when you should not apply these antidotes. And there are other times when you really do have to. So it's a bit like the analogy, Georgie, where, like I said, you have a flashlight and all the batteries are working well, the object appears really bright and clear to you. But if those batteries start getting flat, there's a difference in the way you see it now, don't you? The object's still there, but how you're seeing it's not the same as when the batteries were fresh. Right, so object's still there. Like I said, and this is the difference between this lethargy and laxity. Lethargy, the object can vanish altogether because you fall asleep. You get really dark and black and it's gone. But laxity, it's there. But it's just how clear is it there? Now, what's the nature of the awareness that's holding it? I'm sort of more interested in that.
just a comment on it. It's like you're trying to achieve something that's very, very pure.
Yes, that's right.
Everything else can interfere with that purity.
So. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's many many obstacles that can interfere with the purity of what you're trying to accomplish. This vigilance is the spy of the mind that looks out for the obstacles. So like I said, the obstacles there are primarily excitement. So I don't know, if you've been meditating for a while, there are times when you can actually have the object. But right there with it, it's like, I just call it bubbling, because that's what it's like in my mind, like it bubbles. It's like it's ready to go.
I've noticed that literally about this year sometime. It kind of feels like, and that's when I started to apply the kind of the vigilance with sort of Jada Butcher talked about. It's just like, it feels like this kind of unease.
Yeah.
And then you're like, and that's, it's ready to go. It's almost.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
like I said, I just call it bubbling.
That kind of a feeling.
Yeah, something like coming up from underneath, and it's just going to break through and you're going to be gone.
And what is
it? Well, for me, I just call it, that's excitement for me. So so it's a subtle excitement. Yeah. It hasn't, you know, there's other things, excitement often drives you to external phenomena. But this is like, it's internal.
Yeah.
And you know that if you let it go on, you're going to lose that object.
Yes,
you're going to be off into something else. And so vigilance like picks that up.
Is that
attachment? Yeah, it's a
clarity.
Not to the clarity.
So
just,
you're like excited about the fact that you have that clarity
versus
the clarity.
I don't know if it's so much excitement about you having the object. It's often, it's going to drive you off to some other object. This is often when I'm most weekends, it's like I'm about to lose it.
Yeah.
I know I am because I know this thing. I know what this feels like. And I think this is what we have to do with relaxing. You have to find out, like, what does that actually feel like to you? Yeah, I mean, the analogy is great, isn't it, where the batteries are sort of dying and so the image is not as clear as it normally is. And we can all get that. But then, okay, so what's that play out in my experience?
You're reaching your
edge
of your being.
Oh, for sure.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you keep continuing, that's when you slip into the laxity.
Yeah, that's right. It's, it's not a good idea to continue to keep doing this. You need to stop, actually. It's best thing to stop. You do not want laxity becoming a major contributor to your good meditations. Just because you're on the object, it's not enough. Sandy,
no,
I get you good? Okay. Thank you. This is like mindfulness is the driver with their hands on the wheel. Vigilance is the driver checking the mirrors to make sure they're still on the road. So this stuff again, isn't it? You're holding, you're driving the car.
Yeah,
it's just like, how well are you driving the car? Yeah, this is the problem, isn't it? You'll never be certain that your meditation is free from laxity and excitement. Like I said, so once you get over like gross excitement and gross laxity, then the subtle comes in. So you might be able to tell, I'm tired, quickly, get some water, do something. So you freshen up and so forth, and now you're sure holding it, and you go, wow, I'm doing really well. It's like 20 minutes I'll be able to do this. This is really good. But if you're not checking, you got it, but how have you got it? It's like, yeah, my hands are on the wheel, but I'm on the side of the road. So what's our next one? The most important cause of vigilance. Yeah, as I was saying to you before. And I say, if you want to develop your vigilance, you don't start there. You go back to mindfulness. The most important is like, just get that object up there, hold it, and try and get it as clear as possible. And just keep doing that. That's the major way you increase your ability to be vigilant and your ability to introspect well. The most important cause of vigilance is mindfulness itself. You strengthen it by first placing your attention on an object, like the breath or a Buddha, and actively monitoring that focus. This isn't random thinking, but a skillful check-in. See if your mind is still clear and on task. The act of monitoring is the very practice that builds the vigilance. Again, an application. You start by being mindful of your object, if it was the breath. Then after a short while, you deliberately check in. Is my mind still on the breath? Is it clear? This conscious, purposeful act of monitoring is the strengthening of vigilance. It's not a distraction. It's a skillful tool that keeps your mindfulness sharp. So mindfulness is not a passive state, but an active skill. And it's developed by that conscious, repeated act of monitoring the mindfulness.
Eddie, if you were to say, is my mind still on the object? Yeah. Would that be the domain of mindfulness rather than vigilance? Like actually having the object?
You've got to have, well, these two are really closely related, Ben, and this is one of the things you might get all screwed up about. Going, well, where does one stop and when's the other, and so forth. But like I said, mindfulness is probably just, it's just, like I said, you have to have an object you are familiar with, you don't forget it. Yeah. Let's look at the three things you need for mindfulness. Okay, that's what mindfulness is. So I'm going to put my object up. My breath is familiar to me. What's the instruction though? Well, is it keep the object of the breath at the belly so when you're not up here, right? It's funny, I just did that, but my attention was here. So I go, well, I've lost my mindfulness, haven't I? I'm not even on the object. And so vigilance sort of, oh, that's what's going to be down here, but I'm up here, so I've lost it, blah, blah, blah. So it could be quite a bit of work, but it could be very interesting work if you really want to do this. And there's 16 different ways you can meditate on the breath, the Buddha presented.
But that's not mindfulness.
No, that's just the breath. That's just the object.
Because even when you
think about
the breath.
Yeah. And so we begin with the breath because it's neutral. It's not virtuous. It's not, and it's always there. You're always breathing. As long as you're alive, you're breathing. Right? So it's not something you have to make up. It's right
it's
there.
A strong association, nine times out of ten, you're breathing.
I think what's happening here is that the definitions are different. When you correct me if I'm wrong, what I'm hearing is when you are saying mindfulness, you mean mindfulness meditation in that how it's normally presented is just focus on the breathing, right? Yes.
Okay.
Whereas what Eddie's talking about is mindfulness as a
tool.
As a tool. And it's a different kind of it's more like quality of your attention.
So there are so
irrelevant. Yeah.
So I just take up the Stefan thought. So there are objects of mindfulness, like the breath, like impermanence. There's a whole lot of different topics that you can be mindful of. But mindfulness itself is just a tool. It's and this one is called a mental factor, which is just memory. So like I said, when you look at the term mindfulness, it's memory of or the knowledge of something that you already know about. And you're not going to forget it. That's
holding
it.
Holding it in a form of concentration.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because without mindfulness, you can't concentrate. So mindfulness is to to help us concentrate in this instance. Like I said, there's so much emphasis is put on mindfulness the last 50-odd years. And like so Lama Zopa had a dig at all the people who are into mindfulness, right? And he says, mindfulness, mindfulness, even burglars need to have mindfulness. And you go, that's right.
Even a
burglar needs mindfulness. There's nothing virtuous about mindfulness. It's just a mental factor. So it depends on what you want to do with it. You know, as a tool. What are you going to use mindfulness to create? And here we're talking about creating a concentrated mind. A mind is able to be placed on any object you like, if you want to, and it's going to stay there for 2.5 to 3 hours. That's where you want it to go. Once you have that, you're right on. And what's tremendous about that, of course, is it makes a real great platform for the wisdom, realizing emptiness. That's the point of this concentration, right? We want to be free from suffering and its causes. The only way to do that is with the wisdom realizing emptiness. But if you want to have that wisdom make a definite impact on your mind, you need concentration. You need a basis to rest your wisdom on. And that concentration is not going to take place unless you apply mindfulness, unless you bring your mind back and put it on wherever you want to put it on. And in this one, you'd be putting it on the realization that emptiness provides you, that the things don't have an intrinsic nature. Yeah, so I used to, like how very useful for me, being, well, to stop thinking, and my mind is swimming, because I find it really difficult to swim and think. Right? I do not like swimming and just letting my mind, like, think stuff. I'd much rather like swim and, like, focus on my breath, right? And get my breathing right, and you know, you've got to move your arm up like this and lift up there and do these things. That's all I want to have my mind on. That's all I want to be mindful of. And I know that if I think, this is not good for me. I'm distracted. Yeah, like I said, mindfulness here, so in the last 15 or so years, ever since John Kabat-Zinn started using mindfulness in his practices with cancer patients, right? So he wanted to take religion out of it completely, because they're in America and they're in the hospitals. They don't want that in there. Mm-hmm. So he removed all of that and made it like a secular practice that anyone could do. And he brought into this idea of just the present moment of awareness without being critical or criticizing or anything like that, without being
judgmental.
Yeah, you go, wow, that's a completely new understanding of mindfulness. This is definitely not the Buddha's presentation of it. But it was helpful because it got mindfulness in the hospitals and helped a heap of cancer patients and so forth, right? But then the corporate world grabbed it too and ran with it, right? And then they could be, oh, we can be mindful about work. We can increase productivity and so forth. Right? This is a completely different way of looking at mindfulness. So like Stefan was putting it, we can use it. In this instance, we're using it more as a mental factor, a factor of mind, which is just memory. It's memory, basically. So you can have, you must say, so what do you remember about impermanence, that mindfulness of impermanence? What do you remember about death, mindfulness of death and impermanence? What do you recollect about your breath when you breathe? So I've been doing meditations on Thursday nights, so it's quite interesting, to do mindfulness. This is called mindfulness night, right? So everyone does their practice. So then I ask them about what happened while they were breathing, and nobody knows. Nobody can tell me. It's like, I'm explaining this really poorly. Or people don't sort of get it. It's like, you're meant to, if I say, okay. So I do it like Corrie, right? So I go, okay, this time the object was the breath felt anywhere in the body. It's like, okay, you do that. So you just sit there and do it. It's okay. So where did you feel the breath? I'll say after it. So where did you feel the breath, Stefan? So Stefan, I hope you will say, well, I felt it here, and then it was here, and I did this, and I felt it here and that. And what did it actually feel like to you? And then then people just go blank. Actually, they might say that. Oh, yeah, yeah, no, it's here. Oh, yeah, I could feel when my shoulders went up and came down here, my ribs are expanding, I could feel all that. You know, but then you go into a little bit more detail and they have no memory of it at all.
So that's the vigilance there.
Yeah, there's no, this thing. So I've actually got the object, but no introspection, no vigilance.
They
can't tell you. Yeah, they're driving.
But they're off road. So.
Yeah, like that. Yeah, like that. Yeah. So it's quite, it's fun. Talking. Okay. We've got to use these two together, right? We discuss them separately as normal, but then they have to be used together. Again, maintaining your focus on your chosen object with mindfulness. Well, actually, with memory, just with remembering what to do. That's all it is. Then you repeatedly check. Was my mind becoming lax or was it excited? Like something, this, on Thursday, it's just like, so I'm sitting there, I'm going to try and just, on one hand, I do every time I miss my count or I forget my object, I'm just going to move a finger and just go, okay, that's one, move it more, that's two, that's three, something like this. So, yeah, and you ask people, so how many times did you lose the object? And nobody knows. But again, it's a lack of vigilance. You held it, but then you forgot it. So there's a lot more going on than what we normally think, and it does require quite a bit of effort on our parts, as I think we can all see. But mindfulness holds the breath, and vigilance periodically checks, is my focus on the breath clear? Am I still on the breath? When vigilance spots the mind being dull, then alerts mindfulness to re-engage with it. You've got to hold it tighter. Your way of holding the subject is slack. It's not as tight as it could be. So you need to try and do that. So mindfulness is basically the mental skill of holding our attention on the object, like an anchor, right? Just prevents the mind from wandering. The vigilance or introspection comes along and looks at how well are you doing here? Has the mind become dull or scattering, or is there a bit of excitement coming in? What is it? Anyway, that's our meditation for the evening. That's our class. I'm not going to do this next meditation because basically it's just what I've been saying to you guys about, like, you've got both hands on the wheel. Like, it's this analogy, right? Yeah, you're on, sure, you've got your hands on the wheel, but are you on the road?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, vigilance tells you that. Or if you use the analogy of the flashlight, the light that's on it, okay, there's your mindfulness, but gee, are the batteries down low or they're still powerful? But that's the vigilance part. What do you need to do to brighten up the batteries? You need to brighten your mind. If you want to see that picture clearly, you need to brighten the mind some way. So water, of course, will do it externally, but it's really internal mental work. And so you want to feel sort of, like I said, when I just sit here thinking about the kindness of Geshe and said, oh, I can just notice it. Wow, my mind just changed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, this is how it works. But again, it's one of those things that you need to try. It won't do you any harm. That's a lovely thing. It won't do you any harm. And if you know why you want to concentrate and how beneficial it is, then it can really help you because you want it. Yeah? And I know myself, if you want something, you get pretty good at it, these things. Ah, this is wrong. This is from a different class. I'm sorry. Basically, you understand these two are not correct. They're for a different class. But basically, I hope you all do know what the difference between mindfulness and vigilance is and what each one is trying to overcome. So we have some material up there on pages 39, 44 to 46. And there's a section up there called the nine stages synopsis. That's a map. So if you have a look at that, you'll see the different stages that you go through to cultivate calm abiding. So we've just been talking about the three first stages, basically, which is you place the mind on the object, then you have to continuously place it and replace it. And it's here where you first introduce to mindfulness and introspection. And at the fourth stage, this is really where these mindfulness and introspection really play a major part of it. Because you're going to end up fighting distraction, excitement, accident. So you want to develop these qualities because we're going to need them for a long time, that's for sure. You guys have anything else to finally say before we wrap it up?
What are the time frames? Say if we start working on vigilance, what time frames do we allow ourselves?
Like develop it fully or to develop it well?
To check to see if we've developed it, you know.
Well, I read a book by Alan Wallace, and he spent a year training students in using vigilance and mindfulness to develop calm abiding. And within a year, they had progressed immensely, I thought. I thought, man, he goes up like the seventh stage already in a year. Yeah, so they were doing meditating every day, of course, Westerners.
Yeah.
They were doing quite a lot of sessions every day, but they weren't long sessions. They made sure they were short to deal with the laxity. So within a year, you know, it's concentrated practice. They were able to do it.
Sure.
So I think that's good news for us.
Yeah.
Okay, let's dedicate them. So due to the merits of these virtuous actions, I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha, and all living beings, without exception, do that. Okay, Bodhicitta. May the supreme dual Bodhicitta not be born and rise and grow. May that born have no decline but increase for the Lord. And as long as space remains, as long as human beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. For His Holiness is long life. The wish granting, wish fulfilling joy, the source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And finally, for Dhammasopa, in holding and spreading the Buddha's precious and complete teachings through explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience and is never discouraged. Incomparable benefit, Guru, to you, the Buddha. Thanks, everyone.